about I want to talk about the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument. So this was from 1935. But actually, there were some remarks by Einstein already in 1927, which are a kind of precursor to that. So I'm going to start by talking about that. So one. 1927, there was a Solvay conference. Yeah, and this was a big conference, really the first big conference after the papers of quantum theory had, the quantum theory was invented in 1925. 26, Heisenberg's paper in 25, Schrodinger's paper in 26. So this was a big conference where all the big names in physics at the time were meeting. And you can find a photograph if you go on the web of all the great figures. Einstein was there, of course, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, Niels Bohr, Lorentz was there. So all these big names today talking about quantum theory. So Einstein himself wasn't actually scheduled to give a lecture at the conference, but he made some remarks in one of the discussion periods. Unfortunately, all of these all the remarks were written up, so record of those, and the proceedings of the conference. Well, for a long time they existed only in French, but now you can find an English translation of those. By Guido Bacigalupi and Anthony Valentini. And that's available. You can get the book, which is in the library here, or it's available on the archive. Okay. So this were his remarks. Imagine you have a source of light, and then, or some particles anyway, and then you have a screen, a circular screen, so a diaphragm, which has a pinhole in it here. And then you have a hemispherical shell, very good hemisphere in it, again. Okay, sure, that's better. You have a hemispherical shell like this. So you can imagine a particle comes along, which is this pinhole here, and then diffracts, and then the wave function spreads out, and then at some point, you get this is a I said this is a scintillation screen. At some point, you get a scintillation somewhere on this screen. It could be here. And the question Einstein was asking was, well, when you get scintillation here, we know that that means you cannot get a scintillation somewhere else, for example, here. You don't have scintillations in two places. There's only one particle coming in. Suppose there's only one particle coming in from the source. How do you make sense of that? Because you have here this wave function spread out. I mean, I talked about this a bit in the first lecture. You have the wave function spreading out, and there's no information about where the particle is, and then suddenly the particle makes scintillation here, and that means it cannot make a it cannot cause a scintillation anywhere else. Now, he described this as a kind of spooky action at a distance, as if the whole wave function suddenly collapses to one place, and non-locally it's everywhere else. I don't know what languages people were speaking at this conference. I don't know if Einstein was fluent in French. Maybe he said this in German, then it got translated into French. And, anyway, he said. Really, the argument he's making is he assumed that this wave function that spreads out here is a complete description. It tells you everything about the physical world as far as this experiment is concerned. Then you have a problem because suddenly the scintillation happens here, and so non-locally you can't have a scintillation over here. So there's this tension between completeness and locality. On the one hand, you suppose that things are local, then it's strange that she's non-local influence. On the other hand, if this wave function is complete, then it seems that there's nothing in here. Now, you could try to make a local description. What you could say was, well, actually what happens is a particle comes along, follows some path, gets detected here. And so maybe you have, the particle and the wave function, or just the particle. In any case, so the true story is that you have a particle in addition to whatever else. And that's why you get a collapse. That's why you get the detection here and not here. And this seems like a local account. There's no need now to have any local collapse. But if you do that, you're adding something to the wave function. Or you're saying that the wave function itself is not a complete description. There's something additional there. So the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument is sort of a way of formalizing that. And what I'm going to do is, instead of using the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument, which used two entangled particles, I'm going to take a simplification of this argument and go through the same basic logic and show you where the contradiction is. I mean, it's pretty obvious what the contradiction is, but it's nice to see it in slightly more formal terms. So instead, we'll consider our favorite experiment, source emitter particle. Then we have two paths and two detectors. Really, to make this argument work, you only need two of the infinite number of paths. And so when the particle is emitted, you either get a detection here or a detection here. But just the moment before you get those detections, the wave function is present both here and here. Same. And just to make this a bit more vivid, if you like to use this, so two cups and an orange, okay. And let's see if I can do this. Okay. You do it on the front desk, but there's lots of computers and things there, so I'm going to do it here. So see, there's nothing up my sleeves, okay. So now the orange is under one of those two cups. And if I did it well, nobody knows which of the two cups it's under. Okay, and so I'm going to take one of these cups over here, one of these cups, actually I don't even know which cup it's under, over here. Okay. If I've done that well, nobody, including myself, knows where the orange is. So let's think about this. I should point out, I'm not going to tell you at any point where the orange is, so you'll never know. The orange is either under here or here. Now, if I was to pick this cup up, then either I would find the orange underneath it, or I would not, okay? So we don't know whether it's there or not, but we know if I pick the cup up, I will find the orange here. And in picking this cup up, I don't disturb what happens over there. This is at least according to the locality, you would think I wouldn't disturb what happens over here. So if I pick this cup up and I do find the orange here, then we know for certain there's no orange under that cup. And likewise, if I pick this cup up and I don't find the orange here, then we know for certain that there is an orange under that cup. So without actually picking that cup up, I do know that if I were to pick it up, I could make deductions about the other cup. But if we assume locality, then picking that cup up or not has no effect on what happens over here. That means that it must be the case that under this cup there is an orange or there is not an orange. One of those two things must be true, even though we don't know which. So that's the sort of reasoning. And so let me try to make that a bit more formal. I realize this is all a little bit pedantic, but you know, when you live in quantum foundations for a long time, you start to get that way. So in some sense, what this has to do with is the notion of reality, what's real. Usually, you know, people in philosophy talk about ontology. So the ontology of interpretation of a theory is the set of things that are taken to be real. So here we're asking about where the orange is. Is it really the fact that the orange is under that cup or not? In classical theories, the ontology is usually just pretty obvious. With Newtonian physics, then the ontology is given by the positions of a bunch of point particles along with their velocities. That's the ontology of the theory. Whereas in quantum theory, the ontology is not completely clear. We have wave functions. It's not clear what picture of reality we have corresponding to that. Okay. So let me, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some definitions from the EPR paper. So this is from the some definitions. Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen. And apply it to this simple situation we have here. Okay. So, first of all, completeness. Okay. So, in a complete theory, and I'll read the quote here, every element of physical reality must have a counterpart in the physical theory. Every element. Every element of physical reality, we'll be saying that quite a lot. Call that an EPR, and I don't know if it was deliberate that they chose that expression in this paper. Probably. Every element of physical reality. I want to just supplement with a definition that doesn't appear in that paper, psi completeness. This comes from a paper by Harrigan and Speckens, Speckens' faculty here, which is, I'll write it as this. This is not how they wrote it in Harrigan Speckens' paper. or EPRs, sorry. Save myself some time. All elements of physical reality follow from the state vector. What I mean by that is imagine here we're interested in an element of physical reality over here. So we say the outcome to this measurement as the value alpha. Alpha can be equal to, well, in this case, 1 for detection and 0 for non-detection. It's on system A. If the probability you get when you measure that is 1. So what I'm saying is this is true if this property is true. So if when you calculate the expectation value of the projector associated with that of the value 1. Okay. So now the next thing I want to give, and this is going back to the EPR paper, is a criteria for the existence of an element of physical reality. So this is meant to be a sufficient criteria. Criterion. Okay. And I'll just read this out. So the criterion from the paper is if without in any way disturbing a system, we can predict with certainty, i.e. with probability equal to unity, the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this quantity. I'll write this down. Unity, what you say. Actually, even here, there's an interesting thing. So they say that the probability being equal to unity and certainty are the same thing. And when you talk to people in the philosophy of probability theory, they sometimes disagree with that. This may be a distraction, but just since I'm here. So probability. You sometimes think of it as the limb, as the number of times you repeat an experiment tends to infinity, of the number of times you see the particular result you're interested in, divided by n. Okay. And certainty means that it happens every single time. But here it's possible to have, for example, the limit of n minus 5 over n. And that tends to 1, as n tends to infinity. But 5 times it didn't happen. Some people will quibble about the distinction between probability and infinity at 1.
Why do we need to take the limit of n tending to infinity?
So I realized I'm opening up a can of worms here by talking about probability theory. So there's different interpretations of probability theory, probability in the philosophy of probability theory. So one of them is that it is a relative frequency in the limit as you take n to infinity. So that's just one interpretation of what probability means. Another interpretation is that the probability is a propensity. It's a measure of some intrinsic property of a system. And the third interpretation is that it's a belief about a system. That fits in sort of Bayesian techniques in probability theory, that you update your beliefs when you gain new information. So, I mean, that's just broadly speaking, those are three different interpretations of probability. So, excuse me. So what I said here pertains to the relative frequency interpretation. Of course, you can never measure this because you can never do an infinite number of repeats of the experiment. The philosophy of probability theory is itself very strange, even before you think about quantum theory. It's an interesting subject. Anyway, that was just an aside, and actually those remarks really distract from what I'm trying to say here. So we're not going to make that quibble. We're just going to take probability one to mean the same as certainty. Let me finish writing the quote down. And I'm just abbreviating here. In the original paper, they didn't use the CPR abbreviation. So we can write this down as this. If this is true, okay, and if the measurement of P does not disturb system A, then there exists an EPR And this is true even if we don't measure A or B. This is the same, this is the argument I kind of gave you with the cups and the orange. Any questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Could you give a definition of what DEPR means? Like, what is the element of this group?
What is it?
Yeah.
So the idea is that you have, we're talking about a situation where you imagine that there is some kind of, there are some real things that exist.
Okay.
So physics is not just about making predictions, it's also about saying what things really exist. A lot of issues in interpreting quantum theory are saying, you know, what is it that really exists? And so an element of physical reality is exactly that. It's something that exists. There's that famous, you've probably heard this quote, you know, Einstein once asked, does the moon exist when nobody looks at it?
Why it is not a necessary condition for the existence?
Because you might think things exist even when you don't have this probability one prediction. So they wanted to be very cautious, make a minimal assumption. So the moon example, for example. So if nobody's looking at the moon, you might still think it exists. Whereas if you're in a situation where you can make a prediction with probability one, then you have an even stronger case for the existence of this thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
What do you mean by counterpart in the physical theory?
I gave you the example of Newtonian mechanics. There, the counterparts are these positions and velocities. So those things actually appear in the physical theory. So there's a counterpart between physical reality and the physical theory. So the physical theory is a bunch of, you know, symbols and equations and so on. And you write down something like a state. So there should be something in the physical theory that corresponds to this thing that's real. This is according to that definition.
Is the P operator there? You said, I think it was a projector.
Yeah.
Does this mean that psi is in like an eigenstate or like a vector?
Yeah. So for that to be true, psi would have to be in an eigenstate. Okay. So I need one more definition. Okay, locality. This assumption wasn't explicitly spelled out in the EPR paper, although they frequently talk about locality and so on. But these words will do the job. So locality, a system is undisturbed by choices made at a space-like separation from it. Okay. So then if you want to state the EPR theorem, they would say quantum theory in conjunction with psi completeness. And I think I also. And completeness and locality. Give you a contradiction. And I think by now this is pretty obvious, but let me just continue. Let me spell things out. So we have in this experiment here, my notation. So the probability that A equals 1 given that B equals 0 is equal to 1. The probability that A equals 0 given that B equals 1 is equal to 1. Simple anticorrelation. If we perform B and we see B equals 0, then we have an EPR using locality. Because whether or not we perform this doesn't matter. So this is true independently of whether we perform that. And also, if CP equals 1, then the same thing. We have okay. So, so even if we didn't perform B, then we have an EPR. We don't know what alpha is equal to, but we know that we have some element of physical reality. But the quantum state doesn't satisfy this property here with the projector. Yeah. Regardless of what alpha is equal to, you get a half. And so consequently, we have an element of physical reality, but it's not an element of the physical description. So we violate psi completeness. This is the contradiction. Go ahead.
I don't understand the difference between psi completeness and completeness, because I think that psi is the counterpart which describes the physical theory and.
Yeah. Yeah, so you noticed I hesitated slightly before I wrote this down. I think it might be you can just, the psi completeness is an example in a particular physical theory, i.e. quantum theory, of the notion of completeness. I think we're not using this notion in the general sense, just in the specific sense. So I think don't need this function. Adding an extra condition still makes the contradiction, but this is, in fact, as the theorem goes through, we only use this particular application of that general notion. Okay, so that was different from the EPR argument was slightly different in the sense that they used a singlet state, the two particles. So the state was and the logical structure of the argument was slightly different, but with minor difference. Okay. So what I want to do next is Bell's theorem. And Bell's theorem is actually very simple. We have just under 20 minutes. Let's see if we can make this happen. So we have, imagine some source, it emits pairs of particles, and in the quantum example I'm going to give you, this will be in an entangled state. And then at each end, you perform a measurement. The measurement has a setting. I'll denote the setting by A underscore. And then this measurement has one of two outcomes, either A equals plus one or A equals minus one. And similarly, B equals plus one or B equals minus one. Okay, so two particles are emitted from this source. They go towards A and B. You have a choice of measurements over here, indicated by A underscore. And then you have one of two outcomes, either plus one or minus one, each side. Is that clear? Now, in quantum theory, we describe what happens as we associate a quantum state with this preparation, but we want to consider the possibility that maybe quantum theory is incomplete, and you need to give a more complete specification. So we're going to introduce hidden variables. Lambda, the symbol lambda is most often used to describe the hidden variables. So this is meant to be a complete description now of the what's emitted from the source.
Okay.
So it may include the wave function, it may include anything you want. Okay, this could be any kind of piece of mathematics you want. And then we're going to introduce these result functions. A of A underscore, so that's the setting, and the hidden variables. So we imagine that what happens over here depends on the hidden variables that get emitted over to here, and the setting choice we have. Just it occurs to me, you could imagine there's different hidden variables going each of the two directions. So you could call them mu and nu, but it doesn't hurt then to just group those two things together and call them lambda. So what I'm describing here is a more general
case. Okay.
And so this is equal to plus or minus 1, because that's the two values that we allow for the outcome of this measurement. And likewise, we say that b, we have this result function for b, same thing, equals plus or minus 1. And one notice in particular, we haven't allowed this result function to depend on the setting at the other side.
Okay.
Better case. Okay, so there's this assumption of locality. And that turns out to be enough to get you
to a contradiction.
Okay. So we consider a correlation function. So what we do is we integrate over the product of these result functions. We weight it with some distribution over the hidden variables.
Okay.
And these hidden variables are in some space like that. And we require that this distribution function is normalized. Okay. So John Bell came up with his argument in 1964. And then, actually, the paper was pretty much ignored. No one took any notice of it. And until 1969 or thereabouts, when Clauser, Horn, Schimmelin, Holt got interested, and they wrote a paper. One of the problems with the original paper of John Bell was that the inequalities assumed perfect correlations, and they weren't amenable to experimental tests. These guys made the inequalities amenable to experimental tests. And indeed, Schimoni, sorry, not Schimoni, sorry, Clauser. John Clauser and Holt went on to do experiments to test the inequality. And that was the Nobel Prize. That was the reason that Clauser got the Nobel Prize. So I'll give you the Clauser, Horn, Shimini, Holt version of the inequality. So consider, first of all, just a little bit of mathematics. We have x prime, y prime equal to plus or minus 1. Each of these are quantities that take values plus or minus 1. And we can show that this quantity this is trivial, pretty much trivial to see. If you just write this down as x prime y prime plus y plus x y prime minus y, then this quantity here in brackets can be equal to plus 2, minus 2, or 0. And likewise, this quantity can be equal to plus 2, minus 2, or 0. And if you think about it, whenever this one is equal to plus or minus 2, this one is equal to 0, and vice versa. This quantity can either be equal to, you either have a non-zero number here equal to plus or minus 2, or here. And then you're multiplying it by a number which is plus or minus 1. And so this whole thing overall is equal to plus or minus 2. Now we put x equal to a x prime equal to this. Y equal to y prime equals this. We substitute this into this expression here, and then we integrate over the distribution, and we get Is that clear? And these are the Clauser, Horn, Shimini, Holt inequalities. Take the singlet state. This is the same one I wrote down before somewhere. So we have two spin half particles, and we let the measurement A correspond to the spin measurement on A along the A direction. Okay. So spin measurement along the A direction. So now A is a unit vector. I wish I shouldn't. What I've written here is bad. Sorry. This is not. This makes no sense. At end A, we're measuring this. And end B, measure that, okay. Now, if you do the calculation, you'll get on this state here, you'll get that this is equal to minus A dot B. Okay. So simple calculation, but I'll leave that as an exercise. And now, if I choose my four vectors, A prime, B and B prime, like this, choose these, this is 45 degrees in each case. These are all coplanar. And then I calculate these expectation values, correlation functions, and substitute them into that expression in the middle. Then I get, when it's 45 degrees, I get minus 1 over root 2. So that's for these two, yeah. And then the same for A and B prime, 45 degrees. And the same for A prime and B, 45 degrees. But when I come to A and B, we have a bigger angle there. And so the dot product is negative, and we have this minus sign, which makes it positive. We have this minus sign here, so we have minus 4 over root 2, minus 4 over root 2, which is minus 2 root 2, and that's smaller than this. So this inequality, sometimes just called a Bell inequality, sometimes called the Clausewitz-Shumey-Holt inequality, is violated. So that means that one of the assumptions we made was incorrect when it comes to quantum theory. Okay. Questions?
Yeah.
what is A prime and how is it different from A?
Like, sorry, oh, I should have put. What is what, sorry?
A prime.
Where? A, so the idea is that you have two possible settings you can choose, either A or A prime at one end, and then the other end you have two settings, B or B prime.
Like you measure spindle on the x-axis or you measure it on the
x-axis? So just here, yeah, so this could be, A is where you measure it along the z-axis, B prime is where you measure it along the.
Also from this inequality, we can see that this has to be either plus 2 or minus 2, but I don't see how this has to be, like the integral has to be sandwiched in between.
I went a bit fast over. You also have, we also want the density matrix to be, sorry, this to be positive, because it's a distribution. So let's see. So when we integrate over this, so we're integrating over here. Let me just expand this bit out a bit because I was too quick on this. So what we have is we're integrating plus or minus 2, but that's for each value of lambda. You get a plus 2 or a minus 2. Okay. And we're integrating it. So we can think of it like this. We have quantity which is equal to plus 2 or minus 2. Let's call that quantity C. And it depends on lambda. So sometimes it's equal to plus 2, sometimes it's equal to minus 2. And then this, well, the biggest value this can take is when this is always equal to plus 2.
Then you get 2.
But it could be less than 2. And the smallest value it can take is when this is always equal to minus 2. So that.
Also, one more question. Like, I don't know much about this, but people say that Bell's inequality tells us that we cannot have hidden variables.
So there's a almost an infinite amount of literature on trying to interpret what Bell's inequality tells you. It's not true that it tells you you can't have hidden variables. It tells you you can't have a local hidden variable theory. You can't have a theory which is like the one I gave you here, where the result functions were defined. There. So we define these functions that it depends on. You could have a theory where A depends on A, E, and lambda. So if you have this, that is enough even to have it on one of the two sides, then it blocks the derivation of these inequalities, and you're consistent with quantum theory again. So there are non-local hidden variable theories which are consistent with Bell's theorem. So my feeling is that the real contradiction is with locality rather than hidden variable theories. You'll often find the other claim in the literature. What else can I say? There's another thing here, which this looks like this is a deterministic function. So here you either get plus one or minus one, and so you might think, well, it's determinism that's the problem, but actually, you can get get inequalities that are violated just like this, but where you don't assume determinism, where you have probabilities,
deterministic functions.
So determinism isn't the problem. I think it's really locality that's the cause of the problem. So there's a lot of debate on that.
I think in the end it's really.
And one of the things that's interesting is, for a long time this was just a result in quantum foundations, but then people in quantum information theory started to see that you could use this to do things that you couldn't do classically. So one example is where imagine you have two parties, Alice and Bob, and Alice is given some some variable x, Bob is given some variable y, and they have the task of calculating a function x and y. Well, to do that, typically they would have to communicate classically. And you can put a, for different functions, you can put a bound on the number of classical bits they have to communicate.
Okay, so
you know, it depends on the function that they have to calculate. But you can put a bound on the number of classical bits. And those results existed in classical information theory already. It turns out if you have entanglement, then you can do those same tasks with less classical communication. So this is an example where your Bell's theorem actually ends up being useful. You can also use it to secure quantum cryptographic schemes. So the non-locality properties that you see here are pretty much explicitly being used to make these schemes secure. So it has a lot of applications. And when I look at those applications, what it seems is happening to me is it's to do with the non-local property. Anything else? But there's a lot of different opinions out there.
Okay.
You go then.
So this is two input to output system.
Yeah.
Is there any other generalized inequalities?
Yeah. So a few comments. So first of all, the Clauser-Horn inequalities are, in my opinion, are not quite the best ones. The Clauser-Horn, Shimony-Holt are not the best ones. The best ones are the Clauser-Horn inequalities. They came along in 1974, I think. And those pertain to the same situation where you have two results each side, zero or one each side. And what's nice about those inequalities is they capture the space here. I'm answering your question in an indirect way. You can think about the space of correlations between two parties, all the things that are possible. You can bound that space of correlations just by what's possible logically, which I think will be some sort of polygon, or it'll actually be, this is really in a multidimensional space, so it'll be some sort of simplex, or simplex, some sort of convex. That's right. You can then bound it even further by what's possible as long as you don't allow signaling. Okay, and then that's some shape inside here. Then you can bound it more, say what is possible within, if you only allow quantum correlations. That shape starts to have curved surfaces. Okay. And then you can bound it more and say what's possible if you only allow if you demand locality, L type locality, then you have a shape inside here. Like this. Okay. These are hyperplanes. Okay. And these hyperplanes correspond to Bell inequalities. In fact, if you choose the situation, it corresponds to the Clauser-Horn Bell inequalities. The Clauser-Horn Shimony-Holt don't quite capture the full. The Clauser-Horn inequalities are the ones that capture that. That's where you consider just two outcomes, two settings and two outcomes. But you can consider any number of settings, any number of outcomes. You can also, of course, consider any number of parties. There's a way algorithmically to derive inequalities for each of those situations using linear programming. So you can, in fact, I did this once with Sandu Pescu. We just imported the constraints into Mathematica and it started spitting out pages and pages of inequalities. And these inequalities give you the bounds on this. And you can do it for any number of settings, any number of, so there's an algorithmic way of doing it. So you had a question?
Oh, my question was about De Broglie-Bohm.
Yeah.
variables theory.
Yeah.
What is the relationship to Bell's theorem?
Okay, so there's, first of all, there's a historical relationship, which is that John Bell was inspired to do his work by the de Broglie-Bohm model. He saw the de Broglie-Bohm paper in 1952, which had been largely dismissed. This is actually the Bohm paper. There was also a paper by de Broglie, I think in 1927 at the Solvay conference, and that had also been dismissed. But he saw that what happened there was an explicit hidden variable model. And at the time, back in the late 50s, early 1960s, everyone believed that a hidden variable model was impossible. Von Neumann had a proof that it was impossible to construct a hidden variable model. If you look at that proof and think about it properly, it doesn't really make any sense.
It makes some assumptions that just don't need to be true.
But John Bell
was
fast as a crystal ball. Okay. John Bell was inspired by the 1952 paper of Bohm, because there he saw something done which wasn't supposed to be possible according to the prevailing wisdom. And so that was what motivated him to think about hidden variables. He said, well, okay, these hidden variables theories can exist. But when he looked at the de Broglie-Bohm model, it's actually explicitly non-local. And I'll talk about that in one of the, if I get time, I'll talk about the de Broglie-Bohm model in detail. You can see that the motion of particles over here depend on what happens over here. So that it's an explicitly non-local model. So that's the connection. Okay. Go ahead.
Is that 2 under root 2 bound? Is this the maximum bound for quantum theory?
Okay. Good question. So, and indeed, this relates to this curve here. And you can sort of ask what's the furthest out this thing can go, measured by some distance here. But it is 2 root 2. So for this situation where you have two settings, two outcomes, then regardless of what state you have, 2 root 2 is the maximum bound. And that was proven by Tirrellson. That's the Tirrellson bound. Then there's a bigger problem is, can you actually characterize the whole surface? 2 root 2 only characterizes one feature. This is a curved surface, so it's harder to do, and people have worked on it.
So, we can have entangled states which may not be well non-local, right?
So there's a proof that any state which is entangled, so it's not a product state, will violate Bell's equality. This is for pure entangled states. When you have mixed states, then you have states which are separable. So you can write them down as a convex mixture over product states, and some of those states and you can have states which are non-separable. Some of those non-separable states don't violate the inequality. You get this kind of this non-locality that can't be activated. So there's some literature on that subject. Questions. Okay, I'll see you on Monday.